Parliament's been adjourned for 2 weeks, but will resume next Tuesday. And for a preview of what to expect then, the Acting Leader of the House, Simon Bridges, delivered this business statement on the last sitting day before the House rose.
When the House resumes on Tuesday, 11 October, the Government will look to complete the committee stages of a number of bills on the order paper and the third reading of what was formerly the Judicature Modernisation Bill, presently on the order paper as items 24 to 46, starting with the Senior Courts Bill.
Acting Leader of the House, Simon Bridges. Also next week, select committees will be back in business, as only one committee met this week. The Foreign Affairs, Defence and Trade Committee met behind closed doors on Tuesday as it met to put the finishing touches on its report on the international treaty examination of the Paris Agreement on climate change. The report, which recommended the government ratify the climate treaty, was published on Tuesday, the 4th of October, and the next day, Wednesday the 5th, the government did just that, ratifying the treaty in time for the 22nd conference on the climate deal next month. And when the House resumes next week, the Health Committee will continue hearing submissions on the petition of Marion Street calling for an inquiry into public attitudes towards euthanasia. With around 1,600 submissions due to be heard in person, the committee has decided to split into three subcommittees in order to get through them all. We spoke with the Deputy Clerk of the House, Rafael González Montero. He outlined the reasons behind the Health Committee's decision.
I suppose the committee tried to find ways to hear from more submitters because there's quite a large number of submitters wanting to be heard. And so I guess the committee thought of an innovative way to be able to hear from more submitters at the same time. And so I think that's why they've decided to split into three subcommittees so that they can hear more people. The number of people that want to be heard at the beginning was 1,800. And we've been sending emails to all the people that wanted to be heard and still ask them if they still want to be heard. The last time we did that, it dropped to 1,600. So we're still looking at keeping sending people emails to see if they want to be heard. But at this stage, 1,600, and the committee wants to hear from all of them.
The deputy clerk said processing all the submissions on the euthanasia petition had been quite a job.
It's been the largest logistical exercise that we've had to do in secretariats, because it's been a large number of submissions, and so we've had to do a lot of innovation to get through all of them and work through it all. I mean, we've had to have pretty much the whole of select committees work together to process a large number of submissions, and everybody has pitched in. We, for example, have sent bulk emails to the people that want to be heard, to make sure that they still want to be heard. And there's been a lot of phone calls to people, bulk processing of submissions. Yeah, it's been quite a big exercise.
We also asked what happened if the committee doesn't get through all the submissions before the end of this parliamentary term.
There's various things that the committee can do. One is to present an interim report to the House about what they've heard so far. And then I suppose next year it could be reinstated if the House agreed, and the new committee in the new Parliament could decide how they want to keep going with the petition. So they could decide just to carry on as the current committee has done, or decide something else.
Deputy Clerk of the House, Rafael González Montero. And any decision to carry on business before a committee following an election would effectively be up to the government of the day, which would have a deciding majority on the select committee. Meanwhile, the Standing Orders Committee has made a call for public submissions on the triennial review of standing orders, the rules which govern procedure and behaviour in the House. Tom Frewen spoke with the Clerk of the House, David Wilson, about the upcoming review and began by asking how many public submissions had been received on the last review in 2014.
There were 18 submissions, including one from the Clerk of the House.
And presumably the Clerk of the House's recommendation was adopted?
Yeah, well, she made a variety of recommendations to the committee. Some of them were picked up, some of them were not. I think the committee ran into a bit of difficulty with time in the last review 3 years ago, where the House dissolved in July, and perhaps some of the things it might have addressed with more time, it had to cut its consideration of it short.
Were there any submissions from the public that were wound up in being successful recommendations?
Some of the submissions from the public picked up on matters that were also raised in other submissions, and we usually get some from regular submitters who are frequently interested parties, as well as from most of the political parties and some individual members as well. So they do cover some of the same ground as each other, and some of those things did get put in place. I think some of the significant changes made in the last review included greater scrutiny for compliance with the Bill of Rights Act by select committees when looking at legislation. It required those reports from the Attorney General to the House to be scrutinised by a committee and for it to report to the House for the first time, which has improved the level of scrutiny of legislation from select committees. It also formalised the rules that had been operating over the past 3 years around members' attendance at Parliament and deductions in pay if they don't attend without permission.
Are you expecting any significant changes from this review?
Well, I think the committee started it in good time, and there are always things to look at. I think there's a feeling that the structure of select committees probably needs attention. Because one of the main jobs of select committees is to scrutinise government activity, look at the performance of government agencies, and there have been some major changes in the structure of some of those agencies, thinking specifically about the Ministry of Business, Innovation and Employment, being a very large agency where most of its scrutiny now falls to one committee. So I think there'll be certainly a look at that. But it's difficult to say what other issues will come up. It's really now open to people to have their say. And we have given a little bit more publicity to the fact the review's on this time, hoping to generate more submissions. I've also been round and spoken to all of the political parties about issues that concern or interest them to stimulate some early discussion and thought about how to review the standing orders.
From the point of view of a member of the public, how would they go about thinking about making a submission? It's a very technical area, isn't it, the rules of the House?
It is a technical area, and I would just say to anybody who wanted to make a submission, if they see a problem that they'd like to have addressed, it's okay to contact the committee through making a submission and simply point out what issue or problem or opportunity they see. They don't have to come up with a technical solution, nor do they have to express it in the terms of the standing orders. They can simply highlight an issue they'd like to see addressed, and the committee will consider that, and then we'll help the committee work out a way to express it if they adopt it. So I'd say to people not to be put off by the fact it is quite a technical area. If they have a view about something in Parliament that they think could be changed or could be better, then they should make a submission, and they can do that online or through post.
Doing it online, you go to www.parliament.nz, and then what?
That's right, and then you click on the tab that says Have Your Say. Then one of the options is to make a submission. If you click then on that, it will show all of the items that are currently open for submissions, and one of those will be the review of standing orders. So once you get to the website, just a couple of clicks through to have your say, and then you can make your submission electronically and just upload it. I would just say that the regular review of standing orders is a feature of the New Zealand Parliament, but it's actually quite uncommon overseas to do a regular review of standing orders. Some parliaments make changes to their rules when there's a problem or there's some law change that they need to address, but they don't routinely look at them. Our parliament does, and I think that's a good thing. It makes sure that they stay current. Sometimes they make quite significant changes, as they did two parliaments ago when we brought in extended sittings, which has largely replaced urgency as a mechanism for making greater progress on legislation. Last time round, the changes were smaller, but still, I think, quite significant. So it is a really good opportunity for members and for the public to think about how Parliament can be more effective.
Clerk of the House David Wilson speaking to Tom Fruin, who also caught up with the Deputy Speaker Chester Burrows, who along with Labour MP Chris Farfoy travelled to Adelaide for the annual Australasian Study of Parliament Group Conference. The theme of the conference is the restoration and enhancement of Parliament's reputation. Subjects canvassed include disclosure of donations, the influence of lobby groups, alleged manipulation of the electoral system, and the relationship between MPs and the media. Mr. Burrows spoke on the phone from Adelaide with Tom Fruin about some of the highlights of the conference.
We had a very interesting discussion yesterday with one very outspoken politician from Queensland and four very high-profile journalists across media delivery, one social, one radio, one newspaper, one television, talking about the engagement between media and politicians. The fact is that, you know, we both need each other, and politicians need to get a message out there, and the media want to report the news, and that includes political news. So it's an interesting situation and dynamic where we're not the best of friends, but at the same time, we both need each other to survive. So the way in which news is put together, the way in which it's delivered, what's in the thoughts and minds of the media in reporting the news about politics, but also what's in the mind of politicians and engaging with the media, makes for a pretty unusual dynamic.
Looking at the media's coverage of politics, was there a distinction drawn in the discussion between politics and Parliament, the media's coverage of Parliament specifically?
There was a little bit about the freedom to be able to report and photograph and those sorts of things going on within the Houses of Parliament, but the thrust of it really is that there is two or three things that impact quite badly. One of them is that newsrooms are being gutted as the public have walked away from conventional media. So we used to see a whole lot of investigative work and a whole lot of own motion inquiry by journalists. Now we see virtually nothing. The second thing from a politician's point of view is it doesn't matter how important a piece of news might be, you can be blown off the front page by a ridiculous story that may or may not have something to do with politics. But, the fact is that doesn't matter how careful or precise, how well-researched, put together the legislation is and how timely the policy is, you know, if the politician's standing there with his fly undone, that's what's going to be reported.
Not just a politician. You look at sportsmen and the issue of their use of disabled toilets. Anything can overtake more serious issues.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so you've got politicians saying, well, what are you doing reporting this stuff? And the media saying, well, you know, the essentials of our business are that we are a business. We need to be able to up readership and circulation. So then the integrity of the news is about the truth and the story, not necessarily whether or not the story is worth reporting.
Any other topics that attracted your interest at the conference?
Well, we had one discussion yesterday about how parties and politics have fettered our parliamentarians, which, we tend to think of our parliament operating exactly the same way it is now, even in relation to the configuration of the seating and the sort of adversarial nature of the way the room's set out, as opposed to what they're doing in other countries, which is quite interesting. Recently going to the Utah state parliament at the House and Senate level, they sit regionally rather than in parties, and it leads to a much better behaved House. The other thing is that the whole House only sits for 6 weeks every year. So you've really got to get up and running and get your stuff done in 6 weeks, or else you're shut down for a year. And what it also means is that you can't be a full-time politician. You actually have to get out and get another job, and it keeps you in touch with the real world. That's the view of the folks in Utah. And a number of those facets have actually got quite an interest. I think they're quite an interesting way of looking at things. Our first paper this morning is around lobbying and lobbyists and what their place is. There's also one entitled "The Executive's Contempt for Parliament." So I think all these sessions have got very tasty and intriguing titles. So it should be an interesting couple of days.
Deputy Speaker Chester Burrows speaking there with Tom Fruin. Parliament returned from the two-week adjournment at 2 p.m. on Tuesday, beginning with the swearing-in of a new member, as announced by the Speaker, David Carter.
Honourable members, I wish to advise the House that I have received a letter from Kevin Haigh resigning his seat in the House with effect at midnight on 6 October 2016. I have been advised by the Electoral Commissioner that pursuant to Section 137 of the Electoral Act 1993, Robert Barry Hobson Coates has been declared to be an elected member of the House of Representatives in place of Kevin Haigh.
With that, the new Green MP, Barry Coates, went to the front of the chamber to take the affirmation.
I, Robert Barry Hobson Coates, solemnly, sincerely and truly declare and affirm that I'll be faithful and bear true allegiance to Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II, her heirs and successors according to law.
That was followed by Question Time, which included questions to the Prime Minister about child poverty from Labour leader Andrew Little.
Does the government intend to meet all the targets it has set? If so, why does it think setting those targets was important?
See you right, Honourable Prime Minister.
Speaker, we tend to make good progress towards those targets because they're focused on addressing some of New Zealand's biggest challenges. For example, we set practical targets in the areas that contribute to material hardship and poverty. These include increasing infant immunisation rates, reducing rheumatic fever, increasing early childhood education participation, and reducing the number of assaults on children.
Supplementary question, Andrew Little.
Given the importance he places on targets, why does he oppose Judge Andrew Beecroft, the Children's Commissioner's target of reducing the number of children living in material deprivation by 10%.
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Government's certainly not opposed to the individual components of what Budge Beecroft was talking about. And actually, the government's been doing a great deal in terms of working on those, including increasing benefits and increasing working for family payments and increasing childcare assistance, just as an example. But it's important to understand, my advice is that Judge Beecroft's target is actually comes off a survey or a poll, which is then factored up. So, Mr. Speaker, I don't think that would actually be a terribly good measure. No, it doesn't.
Order.
Supplementary.
Supplementary question, Andrew Little.
Is the United Nations Committee on the Rights of the Child correct that there is, quotes, an enduring high prevalence of poverty among children in New Zealand, end quotes, and if not, why not?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, some children have been in poverty and some families in poverty for a very, very long time in New Zealand's history. I will say the United Nations report doesn't cover the point at which this government was the first government in 43 years to raise benefits for families with children. But, Mr. Speaker, this government is extremely focused on the needs of those youngsters, and that's why we have individual targets and on an individualised basis for a great many of them. But we do not believe, and the official advice does not support, one single target for poverty.
Supplementary.
Supplementary question, Andrew Little.
Why are there more children living below the poverty line, more homeless children, more children in material deprivation, and more working families turning to food banks under his government?
That's right. The Right Honourable
Speaker,
Prime Minister.
I'm sure I wholly accept the member's proposition, but some of those factors have been a result of the recession. But, Mr. Speaker, the good news is that we have one of the fastest growth rates now in the OECD. As the Minister of Finance pointed out in the last answer, one of the fastest income growth rates in the last 8 years. But, Mr. Speaker, that is the very reason why the government did things like not only support working for families in the most difficult times, but actually extend it. It's why we have free GP visits, Mr. Speaker. It's why we were the first government in 43 years to raise benefits.
Order. Order.
Yeah. No.
Supplementary question, Andrew Little.
Mr. Speaker, what does he say to Ebony Andrews of Auckland, who, despite stringent budgeting and working as a learning support teacher, is forced to rely on charity for basics like food, clothing and shoes for her children?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Speaker, I simply don't know her circumstances.
Supplementary.
Order. Supplementary question, Andrew Little.
Why does he think it's possible to kill every rat, stoat and possum across New Zealand, but it's impossible to ensure all our kids have a warm house to live in, good clothes to wear and food to eat?
Well, Mr. Speaker...
No, you're right, Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, actually, this government has been more focused than probably any other government on making sure that youngsters are in a warm house. That's why we've insulated 300,000 homes, multiples more than the previous government did. That's why this government increased benefits for the first time in 43 years. That's why this government's been part of a program with Fonterra and Sanitarium for 7 million, for instance, 7 million breakfasts. But, Mr. Speaker, the official advice doesn't support one single definition of poverty. And actually, interestingly enough, one of the reasons that you might not want to do that is because the opposition themselves say as soon as you put a label on a child, let's say they are now going to be the Ministry of Vulnerable Children, the member doesn't like it, but he wants every kid to...
Order. The answer's now drifting on for too long. Order.
Is that a label?
Supplementary question, Andrew Little. In light of that answer, and in light of Judge Andrew Beecroft's statement that the $25 a week benefit lift hasn't made a material difference to many families, why doesn't he cut the crap, accept that there is a credible measure to be had, and measure his government's performance against it on child poverty?
There you're right, Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I know the member's running out of staff. At a great rate of knots, but he really needs to get some new and better lines and stop just proving to the country he's angry, Andrew, with no solutions to anything.
Mr. Key also faced questions on child poverty from Greens co-leader Matidia Ture.
When the Prime Minister said that his government is, quote, absolutely happy to commit to doing the best that we can to reduce the number of children that are in poverty or are struggling, end quote, why does his best exclude a child poverty reduction target?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Speaker, because the official advice is that there are a great many ways of measuring children that may or may not be in poverty. And one of the problems with having an individual target is you would then spend your time, potentially stigmatising a lot of kids, B, not giving the money to areas that you actually need, like rheumatic fever, and thirdly, disagreeing with it. The member's definition of homeless people is 41,000 people, including people living on couches. The member's definition of poor children is 360,000. The government's is 60,000. There you go. We don't agree.
Order. Order. Supplementary question, Matidia Ture.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Does the Prime Minister agree with the Ministry of Social Development's technical measure that there are 230,000 New Zealand children living in households with incomes at 60% of the after housing costs anchored line?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I'm sure if the member is doing justice to the report and reading it out correctly, that will be correct. That will be the report commissioned by Brian Perry, which is the most definitive guide to measuring hardship in New Zealand. And I quote, when the report says there is no evidence of increased poverty, rates of material hardship in children have fallen in recent years.
Supplementary question, Matidia Ture.
Does the Prime Minister accept the Ministry of Social Development's official advice that there are 85,000 New Zealand children living in severe material hardship?
Speaker,
the Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Speaker, yes, and that's why the government has been saying for some time, when the member's been going out there inflating the number of children in extreme poverty, that the government's definition is between, or best calculation is between 60 and 100,000. At that point, we were saying that we didn't have Brian Perry's most recent report, but the indications were it would be around the midpoint, and indeed it proved to be that.
Supplementary question, Matidia Ture.
Can the Prime Minister tell the House what is wrong with these internationally accepted official measures used by MSD and why they are not an appropriate measure of child poverty against which he can set targets for reduction?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Speaker, there's absolutely nothing wrong with them. And that's what the government does. It uses exactly that data and then it sets individual targets for things like immunisation, for areas like participation in early childhood education. It looks at income issues for families most at risk. That is the whole point. The government goes out there, and this government has done more than any other government to do exactly that in terms of insulating homes, in terms of maintaining working for families and extending it, making sure there are free doctor's visits, that is, and putting significant resources into rheumatic fever. That is the point. The government uses the data and then assesses individual targets.
Supplementary question, Matiria Ture.
If the Prime Minister accepts these official measures and he has set targets in 32 other policy areas, why will he not establish these measures as official measures and set child reduction poverty targets, child poverty reduction targets as a result?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the government has chosen to set individual targets on an individualised and component parts of what might be defined as poverty. We think that is a better and more effective way of making sure we're delivering for these kids. And these kids are the top priority of the government. That's why we've been putting so much money into areas like rheumatic fever and insulating 300,000 homes, making sure that the top priority for those homes now are in fact actually those that are occupied by the least well-off New Zealanders. The member is saying that there is one definition of poverty. There isn't. And the moment that you do that, the member will then come back and say she's effectively stigmatising a whole bunch of kids.
Order.
Supplementary.
Order. Supplementary question, Matiria Ture.
At the very least, will the Prime Minister commit to reducing the number of children living in severe deprivation, a measure that he has publicly accepted as accurate, by at least 10% by the end of next year?
Speaker. The Right Honourable Prime
Speaker.
Minister.
Going to set a particular reduction target, but what I will do is continue to do what the government has been doing, which is focusing absolutely on those children. And that's one of the reasons why the government has been saying these children that are in that group is between 60 and 100,000. It's why we're the first government in 43 years to raise benefits. But, Mr. Speaker, I will raise one issue for the House.
Order.
Sir,
Order. I haven't called the member.
So the Prime Minister has answered the question quite fully. If he has other issues to raise, I suggest he does that in other questions.
Order. And that's not a point of order. I think it's a valid point, but it's not a point of order. It's for me to decide when an answer will come to a conclusion. Is it a point of order?
No, I want to carry on my answer.
No. I actually, on this point... Order. The Prime Minister was... No, on this occasion... Well, it's not a point of order. I said I actually accepted it was a reasonable point. The answer was given very clearly at the start of the answer, and I was about to rise to my feet to bring the Prime Minister to a conclusion. I don't have to anymore.
The Speaker, David Carter. I'm Rhys Lyon, reporting for ParliamentToday.co.nz with funding from Parliament.